Today, basically, our timeline is relatively short because we're really going to be talking mostly about the first decade of the state. Okay, if last time we talked about the War of Independence and lead up to that, now we're in the challenges that are after the war, right? We've gone through the period of Yehoshua and we're in Shoftim. How do we settle? How do we deal with the challenges of security and of the economy and all sorts of things like that? And we're going to see that the Negev is a very big part of that story. So the war ends. All right, the war ends. We'll see the timeline in a minute. 21 of the Negev communities, of these communities in the area near Gaza, survive, but many of them are really almost completely emptied of their inhabitants. Okay? Mothers, children were evacuated. A lot of people left. And the question is what to do now, how to rebuild those communities and many more. Okay? We have hostile borders. We have a great need in the early years of the state for food. Our economy is in a terrible place. And we're going to see that there's a huge challenge of massive immigration. All of these things seem to add up to, well, let's settle the negative. That's a good solution, but it's not so easy to do. So that's really what we're going to be dealing with today. This picture, we have a lot of nice pictures today of 1950s, 1960s Israel. This is a picture of Kibbutz Kisufim in 1951, settled largely by immigrants from South America, right? There are a lot of South Americans in this area of the Otef. Okay, let's take a quick look at our timeline here. Even before the war is over, August 1948, David Ben-Gurion establishes the Nachal. Okay, Nachal, as we're going to see, Noar Chalutzi Lochem, fighting and pioneering youth. We're going to come back to them. They're going to be very important in our settlement story. Okay? By the end of 1948, the Negev is conquered completely by Israel. Gaza is in Egyptian hands. Okay, but the Negev has been conquered, which was not necessarily that was not something that everyone assumed was going to happen, but it does happen. Between 49 and 56, we're going to see those years. We have many, many places that are founded, but we have 30, quite a large number, new communities of Olim, okay, Moshavot Olim, as opposed to cities, as opposed to towns. We're going to come back to all these things. And we have a few other, I just wanted a few other points in here of different places we're going to talk about. 1949, Kibbutz Erez is founded. 1951, the first Nachal settlement in our area, Nachal Oz. In between now, in the 50s, we're going to see the founding of various development towns. The first one is Sderot, then Ofakim, then Netivot. In between, terror attacks, IDF reprisals. That's also quite a bit of our story. And then at the end, we have a little bit of a surprise, 1977. I'll leave it till we get there to talk about the Vietnamese boat people. Okay. So let's understand what are the facts on the ground, right? What's our post-war situation? First, just to understand our borders. Okay? And this is a map that I'm sure a lot of you have seen many times, but it is important for us to get a sense of what are we talking about, right? We have this area, of the Gaza Strip. Under Egyptian control, not annexed by Egypt, okay, but under Egyptian control, with Jewish communities really very close, right up next to the border. In general, Israel between 49 and 67, the armistice lines of 49 are very, very difficult borders. This is little Israel, right? We have our narrow waist, the narrowest being over here by the area near Netanya, Hadera, right? This whole area of Judah and Shomron, Judea and Samaria under Jordanian control. Of course, the Golan is in Syria. The Sinai is in Egypt. These are our small borders. On the other hand, we're very happy that we are here, right? Which was not so clear throughout the 48 war that we were going to survive. So these are the borders that we're working with. And obviously for us, what's important is this presence of Egypt so close by. Okay. Look at this map in the middle. Okay. This is one of the great maps of Martin Gilbert. Martin Gilbert is the best. If you want good historical maps, he's your guy. This gives us a sense of Arab refugees. Okay. We know that as the war progresses, There are Jews that have to leave certain places like the old city of Jerusalem, but there are quite a lot of Arabs who have to flee from Arab towns like Lud and Ramla, Ashdod and Ashkelon, which are really villages, not towns, Beersheba, right? All these places, where are they going? And for us, what's important on this map, all of it is important, but for our class, 26% of the refugees, almost 200,000 people, go into the Gaza Strip. Okay. They're coming not only from the Negev, right? The Bedouin towns in the Negev, but there are also a lot of Arabs that are coming from Beersheba, from Ashdod, from Lud, from Ramla. Okay. Some of them are going into Judea and Samaria, into the West Bank, but quite a lot of them are going into the Gaza Strip. Refugee camps that are set up there. Okay. And the Arab governments are not interested in taking in these refugees, right? The huge contrast between what Israel does with its refugees and what the Arabs do with their refugees, we won't even talk about, but we all know that. The idea is to keep these refugee camps going. And as we all know, there are refugee camps that have great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren of the original refugees, which is a crazy situation. And obviously they're overcrowded, they're terrible conditions, and that's going to lead to some of the attacks on Israel and to the very terrible, one of the very terrible stories, story of Roe Rothberg, we'll talk about at the end. Okay, so that's very important to understand that as well. And also just take a look at our last map here. We're going to hark back to this area on the map various times, but let's just have a little bit of a sense of where we're talking about here. Okay, so a lot of the kibbutzim, the yeshuvim that are immediate post-war are very much right near the border, right? So we have Yad Mordechai, we have Be'eri, okay, we don't have all of them in here, but Tikuma, which is not so far away, and we're going to see that there are going to be more that are going to be created right along the border, and these are a lot of the Nahal settlements, okay? We're also going to be talking about, is somebody erasing for me? That's kind of cool. Who's doing that? Okay, we're also going to be talking about the development towns. So just to understand where we are, Sderot, Tivot, Ofakim, okay? We're also going to be talking, and this is part of the story that's not told as much. We hear about the kind of veteran kibbutzim. We hear about the development towns, but we don't hear so much about these Moshavot Olim. And that a lot of that is going to be along this Route 241 here, not only. Okay, other places also, Shokeda, Gilat. Okay, but that's just to give a little bit of a sense. I think I have like a disappearing, so weird. Okay, fine. Moving right along. The war is over. And the mission is to settle the Negev, right? Why? We have great needs in these early years of the state. Okay. We need a place to put many, 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 many people who are coming in here. We'll get a look at the numbers and the waves of Aliyah in a little while. Okay. We need a security barrier. We have a hostile border and we need to have a human barrier to protect against that hostile border. Something that we don't think about so much. Well, we were thinking about it a little bit here in the beginning of the war. We have great food insecurity in Israel of its first few years. Thank God that's really not something we think about so much, although in the last few months with the crisis in agriculture, we're thinking about that a little. But in 1948, Israel's economy is terrible. Imports are basically almost nothing. There's not enough food. There's really not enough food to feed all these people. So you need space, you need security, you need farmers and people to work agricultural settlements. The Negev is your perfect solution, right? You have all this space. You can do agriculture down there. Everything will be great. And this is this vision to settle the Negev. This is also largely David Ben-Gurion's vision, right? You have this nice picture, this kind of idyllic picture of him in stable care in the Negev. Of course, when he retires from politics, he moves down to the Negev, but he's always going back and forth. But this is his dream, is to be a laborer in the Negev, and he believes that the future of the state of Israel is in the Negev. You see this great Keren Kayamet poster here, Yekum Chazon HaNegev, the vision, the destiny of the Negev is going to be fulfilled. Geula v'mayim la'arvot hashmama, right? Redemption and water to the wastelands of the desert. That's pretty fancy language. However, there's a bit of a problem. Okay. Jewish settlement organizations don't know so much about the Negev. The Negev, in many ways, in the 40s and 50s, is a great unknown. Okay. There's very little settlement there. Even we talked last time, the 11 settlements, right? There's more than there was in the 1920s, but much of it is not known. It's not been mapped out, and they don't really understand the potentials and the pitfalls. The British had done a survey and said there's not enough water in the country. The population can't grow beyond a very small number. I think it's like 1.5 million people. The Jewish settlement organizations, they drastically underestimate. The Jewish settlement organizations go in the other direction. They drastically overestimate, and they believe that there are more water sources in the Negev. They think that they'll be able to sustain agriculture very easily, and they're wrong, right? They're wrong, and it's going to take a long time for agriculture to really take off. They believe there are natural resources down there, minerals, oil. Also, no, we have not yet discovered oil. Gas, yes, oil not. So there's a little bit of an overestimation of what the Negev can do for us, but that doesn't stop people from getting started. So of the communities that existed before the War of Independence, okay, some of them relocate. Okay, Beirut Yitzchak, we mentioned last time, moves further north towards Petach Tikva. Kfar Darom, which was in the Gaza Strip, has to leave. Beit Eshel near Beersheba also moves all the way north to the Jezreel Valley. Okay, others relocate to the northern Negev, right? They come from areas near Beersheba. They come to the northern Negev. And then there are some internal movements, right? Kibbutz Nirim moves a little bit. Be'eri moves a little bit. The goal is to bring back the residents of the original communities. In the pictures here, you have Kibbutz Nir Am. That's over here on the left. And one of the original buildings of Kibbutz Sa'ad, right? One of the religious kibbutzim. And the goal is to bring people back, okay? And so much, so when I was preparing this class, I was thinking so much of history repeats itself, right? We are in so much of the same situation today. We have these beautiful, wonderful, thriving communities, and people have to have the security to be able to come back. So here it was not only the security, it was also the physical, economic conditions, but they want them to come back. Many communities do return. Okay, just to give you a little bit of a list, names that we had mentioned before, Ruchama and Dorot and Niram and Yad Mordechai, Sa'ad and Tkuma and Nirim and Se'elim, right? A lot of the communities do return and manage to start rebuilding. But along with that, we need to have some new communities, okay? Now, we're going to basically see three different types of communities that are going to be created. The first one is communities that are created by the youth movements, by former soldiers, by army units like the Nahal. And we're going to explain what that is. Hey, that's one set. And a lot of those are very close to the border with Gaza. They're kind of more, they're not veterans because they're all young, okay, but they're veteran Israelis, meaning what does that mean in 1949? It means they're one or two generations in the country, and they get more training, they get more support. That's one type, okay? We're also going to talk about the communities, the Moshavot, that are founded for the Olim, for the new immigrants, largely from Arab countries. And then we're going to talk about the urban centers, right, the development towns, which are also for Olim. So first, let's talk about these youth movement communities. So one of them, we're not going to talk about all of them. I brought a few examples. So one of them is Erez, right? If you look here at the map, I did a little zoom in of the map. I love how Google Maps highlights the Star Lounge of Beit Hanun. We're all going to be going to hang out there on Saturday night. Okay, so here's Erez, right? For many people, they hear Erez, the name that's really famous is the Erez crossing, Ma'avar Erez. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But Erez, as you can see, very, very close to the Gaza border. Yad Mordechai, which was one of the closest, is quite a bit north of Erez. Netiv HaAsara is not here until the 1970s. Okay, so Erez is really one of these border kibbutzim. It's founded in 1950 by the socialist youth, the Noar HaOved VaHaLomed from Petach Tikva. A lot of them came from the army unit of Chativat Yiftach in the Palmach. Some of them fought down here, and they create a new community here. The pictures that you have here, the picture on the left is the old water tower of Kibbutz Erez. The picture on the right is interesting. It takes us back to our second class, reminding us that we are not the first people to come and settle here. This is a Roman mosaic of a guy in like a kind of a Roman outfit, schlepping some animals along on a leash. And we think, because it doesn't have any religious symbols, it doesn't have crosses, it doesn't have menorahs, that this was just a wealthy villa, somebody's fancy house that lived here. And this brings us back to what we were talking about, right? This is a Gaza is a very important economic center. You have all sorts of businesses that are here. And when you have an important economic center, you have rich people, right? So there are mosaics that are discovered around here, some of which are religious and some are just private. Erez is probably most famous for what we said, the Erez crossing. Actually, let's go back for a second, right? Here's Erez and here is Ma'avar Erez, right? The Erez checkpoint, the Erez crossing or the Beit Hanun crossing, it's also called. Okay. It's the only crossing in, into the Gaza Strip for individuals as opposed to for cargo. It's already founded in 1948. If there were prisoners of war that needed to go back and forth, if Israelis wandered by accident into the Gaza Strip or vice versa. That's the picture that you have here on the left. These are a fisherman, Arab fishermen from the Gaza Strip, whose boat somehow got into Israeli waters. Oops. And they were brought back and brought back into Gaza through the Erez crossing. Okay. Until the 70s, there was actually a rail line that went through here. In the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there really were thousands of people that would pass through here every month, Arab workers coming through the crossing, going to work in Israel. When Hamas came into power in 2007, Israel really kind of cut off access and very few people were allowed back and forth. Today, well, after the terrible attacks that were there on October 7th, this is one of the crossing points for the army, which is, of course, what you're seeing in the picture on the right. So that's Ma'avar Erez, close to Erez. Let's talk a little about the Nahal. Nahal is close to my heart. I have to say I didn't know so much about the Nahal, but now my son, my second to youngest, that's his unit. He's serving in the Nahal. So we like the Nahal, the Green Berets. As you can see on the stamp down here, that stands for Noar Chalutzi Lochem, right? Pioneering fighting youth. And their symbol, their original symbol, they actually have like a jazzed up new symbol, but their original symbol is not so different if you're familiar with the Palmach symbol, right? The Palmach symbol is a sword and sheaves of wheat. Okay. This is a sword and a sickle. And olive branches, meaning they are workers, they are fighters, they're farmers and fighters. That's their goal. The youth movements, Israel has always been strong on youth movements, and in during the War of Independence, the youth movements go to Ben Gurion, and they say, listen, we want to be a special unit of our own because we have goals that we want to accomplish. We want to be involved in settlement, and we don't want to be divided up among various units. We want to create our own unit that's then going to focus on settlement, and Ben Gurion agrees, and that's what they do, and that's their original goal is to settle in places on the periphery. And if you look again, Gilbert, right, you have all of these circles, right, are Heachzuyot Nachal, right? These are Nachal settlements, all of them. are in areas that are essentially not super safe, right? On the border, this is between 51 and 67. If we had an updated map from 67 on, you also have a lot of Nahal settlements in the Jordan Valley, right? That was another idea, was to populate this area. But the idea is send young people to set up communities in areas that need to be Judaized, right? We need to have a presence there for security reasons, for agriculture reasons. Eventually, the goal is that this Heachzut Nachal, this kind of like a holding of the Nachal, is going to turn into a civilian settlement. And that's really what happened with all of them. But the early stage is that they go down there and they create these yishuvim. And we are going to be talking, well, you can see in our area, we have quite a few: Kerem Shalom, Nir Oz, Ein HaShlosha, Kfar Maimon, Kfar Aza, Or HaNer, Sde Yoav, and Nachal Oz. Nachal Oz is the one we're going to be talking about. The other reason you might be familiar with the name Nachal is because of the Nachal band, Lahakat HaNachal, right? Some of the really nice Israeli songs performed by the Nachal singing group, which is not such a big deal anymore. It was a very big deal in like the 60s and 70s. And if you want to hear some of the really nice songs, you can go back and listen to the Nachal songs. But this is Kibbutz Nachal Oz. Right? This is the first Heachzut Nachal in our area. It's one of the first altogether. Founded in 1951, really very close to Gaza, right? As we can see here, Nachal Oz, right up against the border, 2.5 kilometers from Gaza City, much closer to the border itself. The statement here is a statement, Zionist adage, right? That the border will be the last furrow that is plowed. Meaning we don't have fences. We don't believe in fences. We farm as far as we farm. That's as much as we're able to settle. And that was the concept, the security concept, in Nachal Oz. Right, that they're going to farm all the way up to the border. And that's really what you're seeing here. But of course, the farming is also accompanied by defense, by fighting. It can't be one without the other. We're going to come back to Nachal Oz towards the end of this class. But in 1953, it becomes a civilian settlement. So 51, it's a Nachal community, and then it eventually becomes a civilian settlement. Now, up until now, we've been talking about former soldiers, kibbutzniks, religious and secular, but essentially vatikim, right? Veterans. Now we're going to be moving into a very different population. Okay, so in order to understand that, let's do just a little bit of background about this story of the Great Aliyah. Okay, between 1948 and 1953, the first 5 years of the state of Israel, Israel doubles its population, right? That's unprecedented pretty much in the history of the world. We go from 600,000 people to 1,200,000 people in 5 years. This also will explain to us why we have this crisis of food on the one hand, and this crisis of where to house people on the other. Okay? We are mostly going to talk about Jews coming from Arab countries, but of course, we have many coming from European countries post-Holocaust as well. We're going to talk about Arab countries because that's largely the population that comes down here or is brought down here. These, of course, are Jews from Yemen. This is a very famous picture. Someone colorized it recently and found out who all the people are, which is kind of neat. Why are all these people coming? So there are a lot of different motivations, right? The Jews who are coming from Europe post-Holocaust are survivors. They are refugees. They have nowhere to go. The Jews who are coming from the Arab countries, it's a combination. Okay. You have Jews like these Yemenites, like a lot of the Jews from Morocco that have a deep, deep faith and belief that this is it. We're in the Messianic age and this is the time and you have to come. Now, their life was not so good in these countries either, but but they're really their motivating factor is Zionism and Judaism. You have others who are coming because of persecution and because of economic troubles, right? Once Israel becomes a state, life, which had been pretty good for Jews in places like Iraq and Syria, becomes terrible, right? There are attacks, there are pogroms. Even before Israel becomes a state, Jews are not allowed to take their possessions with them. So you have many different motivators why people come. The numbers are unbelievable, right? So just to give you a sense, and we're not going to go deeply into this, this is not a class about the Great Aliyah, but it's just interesting to see, okay? Some Aliyot are almost all at once, right? The Jews of Yemen, within a year and a half, basically the Jewish population, 50,000 people, empties out. Jews of Iraq, also very, very quick, happens, not easy, right? They have to pay off the government per head, but 129,000 coming within a very short time. Other countries like Morocco, like the countries of North Africa, it's slower. Hey, they come in a more gradual way, but you still have these huge numbers. Moroccans, 260,000. Hey, the other smaller Moroccans is definitely the most, but Tunisia, 56,000. And it creates a situation, and this is just interesting in and of itself, of Israel, which up until the 40s, while there were some Jews from Arab countries, particularly Yemenites, the majority was Jews from Poland, from Russia, from Germany. And suddenly you have this huge influx of Jews from Arab countries, and it changes the culture, the language, the so many different things change. Just again, one last thing, just to get the numbers right. Just these phenomenal, insane numbers, okay? 100,000, 48, 240,000, 49, 170,000, 1950, right? It's crazy, crazy numbers. So our crisis is, okay, well, where are we going to put them and what are we going to feed them? Okay, so the first wave, the first ones that come, even the ones who come in 48, really, 48, 49, where are they being put? Arabs are running away from their cities like Lud and Ramla. They're running away from their neighborhoods like Katamon and Baqa and Jerusalem. And Jews are moving into those abandoned apartments. And if you look, right, 1948, the majority are coming from Europe. Both the fact that they get here early, and the fact that they tended to get more preferential treatment, meant that they were able to move into the major cities, right? And that's going to be a very important difference. Later on, those places are not available. What are you going to do with all these people? So they first put them into abandoned British army camps. Terrible, untenable situation. Sanitary conditions are terrible. There's no work. It's just very bad. So Levi Eshkol, who eventually becomes the prime minister, but at the time he's the head of the settlement branch of the Jewish Agency, he says, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create temporary settlements, we'll call them ma'abarot. While they are living in these temporary settlements, they'll go to work. Meanwhile, we'll build permanent housing. Anybody who has ever seen the fabulous movie of Salah Shabati, which if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's a satire on this whole situation, of living in the Ma'abarot and being sent to work in the forests. And it's not an easy situation. Now this is the goal. The goal is that they're going to live there and very quickly we'll be able to put up some new housing and they'll move in. There are 140 Ma'abarot in total. Some of them, become cities, right? They start out as Ma'abarot, like Kiryat Malachi or Kiryat Shmona in the north, and they eventually become cities. Some of them are dismantled. The conditions are terrible, right? It's freezing in the winter. It's boiling in the summer. There's no proper roads. There's flooding when it rains. It's bad sanitary conditions, just bad. The work conditions are not too wonderful either. And there's just a lot of crises, and the people who are around to deal with the crises are 18, 19-year-old soldiers, because as you can see in this nice picture on the left, the heads of the Jewish agency or the big guys in the army show up, take a picture, smile, and leave. And this is not so different from how things are today. But the people who are left with the troubles on the ground are these everyday soldiers who have to deal with health issues, right? Here's a kupat cholim, right? A health fund on the right. Have to deal with schooling, teaching these people coming from all over. They have to learn Hebrew. They have to learn how to function in the society here, figuring out how they're going to make a living, getting them glasses and shoes, right? Lots and lots of difficulties. It's not a good situation. There's a lot of cultural bias. Maybe we'll have a few minutes to talk about this at the end, but they're really doing the best they can and trying to save the lives of all these people. But ultimately, it's not a good situation. And again, we have this food crisis. So Eshkol comes along again and he says, you know what? No more ma'barot. We're going to create moshavot olim, okay? Settlements for these new immigrants where everybody's going to get a little plot of land and they're going to farm. And this way we'll solve both problems. They'll have a place to live and jobs and things to do with their day, and they won't be slothful, and we'll have food. And that's the concept between creating these places, okay? And they start out, and eventually it works, but it takes a very long time to work. And now, interestingly enough, the Vatikim, right, the older communities, they say, oh, this is a terrible idea. These guys, they have no experience with farming. They have no discipline, right? There's a lot of bias, especially against the North Africans. They're lazy. They're not going to be able to do a good job. And meanwhile, the Olim themselves are not exactly thrilled to be dumped in these places in the middle of nowhere and to be told, well, okay, it was very nice if you were a banker in Libya, but now you can raise chickens in Tifrach, right? That was basically what we did. But Israel in the 50s was a very paternalistic socialist state, and where the government told you to go, that's where you went to a great extent. And they start to create these communities. I brought you a couple pictures here. This is a picture actually from Nitivot, but it's just a nice illustrative, you know, working your land picture. The picture on the right here is from a community called Patish, where you can see in the middle, the short fellow who's visiting, that's Ben-Gurion. Okay, Ben-Gurion came to visit them because there was a terror attack that we'll talk about later. There was a terror attack in the community. He came to encourage them, don't worry, things will get better. Again, a lot of history repeating itself. And in 7 years, between 49 and 56, 30 of these communities are created. And a lot of them are religious, but because the Olim are religious, you have people who are coming, a lot of North Africans, Moroccans, Tunisians, you have Jews from Kurdistan. One of the things that's interesting, the conditions, as we're going to see in a minute, the conditions are terrible. And the ones who stick it out are largely the ones who came from bad conditions in the first place, right? The Egyptian Jews, who were pretty cosmopolitan and wealthy and city dwellers, they couldn't hack it. They left a lot of these places. And the Kurdish Jews, who were used to very difficult conditions, were really the ones who stuck it out. The pictures that you have here, these are two different places. The one on the left here is Moshav Gilat. This is one of the early houses. And on the right, this is not a picture of the community, but right outside the community, this is Shokeda, a religious Moshav that this time of year is covered in these carpets of the Kalani, the red anemones, and people just come to see it, Darom Adom. So Shokeda, right outside of Shokeda, is Shokeda Forest, and it's one of the places that just in normal years fills up with thousands of people every weekend coming to see these flowers. Now, what are the conditions of these places, right? These buses with Olim come, and they're essentially dumped in these places, which start out with three huts, okay, which are all-purpose buildings for the school, the kindergarten, the makolet, right, the little tzarchania that's going to sell whatever food they have, the synagogue, right, the moedon, the club where you hang out, right, three structures around it, 60 to 80 tents, and a water container, right? And the idea is that you're going to be laboring already from the beginning. No free lunch. The government's not giving you anything. You're going to work to build your own homes. Some people, even when they were working to build their own homes, they were sent as hired labor to the kibbutzim around. Everyone got a small plot. And again, here's this overestimating. That plot was really not enough to make a living on, and there wasn't enough water for agriculture. A lot of the beginning crops were potatoes and onions, which, by the way, most of the potatoes today still come from this area. It took about 10 years till you could make a living in these places. And even then, it wasn't exactly like an economic paradise. But it took about 10 years till they really could get started. Now, a lot of these communities are founded along this road. It's Route 241. Okay, this is going from west to east. Here's Ofakim. Okay, and we have a whole concentration of communities: Patish, Maslul, Piduyim, Ranen, Bitcha. These are all founded at the same time in March of 1950. This road is called Kvish HaRa'av, the hunger road. Why? It's sort of a strange road. It kind of goes a little bit from nowhere to nowhere, and that's on purpose. The British in the 1940s, in 1946, there were a few years of drought, and there was a famine among the Bedouin, and they wanted it. It was like a public works project, and they put them to work building this road, which was the idea was it was going to go all the way to Gaza, and it was a way for the British to have a supply line from Gaza all the way to Beersheba. And these are the Bedouin working here. It got the name Kvish HaRa'av, the hunger road, because it was created so that people would not starve. Okay, now these communities, these Moshavot Olim, are in a very different world than the communities of the Vatikim, of the veterans. They're very close to each other physically, but they're very different. The kibbutzim have a lot more backup from the state. They have a lot more education. They have a lot more knowledge about agriculture. On the flip side, they have a lot more security problems because they're the ones who are right up against the border. Okay. The Moshavot Olim are less educated, less knowledgeable about farming, but they're a little bit of a safer area, even though they also are attacked. There's very little connection between the two groups, and they really don't have much of a common language. Today, these things are all different, right? We're talking about second, third, fourth generations, but certainly in those early generations, there was not much connection between the two. The idea of the Moshavot Olim was a good idea, right? Self-sufficient farmers get them out of these ma'abarot, not in refugee camps. In reality, it was a lot harder than it was thought, in this kind of utopian thought. Okay, now another stage that we want to talk about is that of development towns, right? Ayarot Pitua, Hebrew. Anyone who came to Israel in the 70s, 80s, even the 90s knows what an Ir Pituach, what a development town looks like. And so a lot of people said it's an oxymoron. It's not developed. It's very depressed. We're obviously going to talk about the ones near us, but we have this nice map of all the different ones. And of course, we have in the north, Migdal HaEmek, Afula, Beit She'an, and Nazrat Elite, right? A lot of these towns. And the concept of them was, how's the Olim settle the border areas? Same idea, but on a larger scale, right? So if you look, we're not going to talk about these, but also in the Negev, you have Yerucham, Dimona, and Arad. Arad's not really a development town. It's a little different. Not sure why it's on this map. Okay. But by us, we're going to talk about Ofakim, Netivot, and Sderot. Okay. And that's the stories that we're going to be looking to. A lot of North African immigrants, we're going to see Moroccans, Tunisians, they come and they're put on a bus and they're told that they're going to be taken to Tel Aviv. They're going to be taken to Jerusalem. They end up in the desert with nothing. And they are none too pleased. But they don't have too many choices, and they have to start and they have to build up these places. For many years, the term development town basically meant economically disadvantaged, no jobs, no prospects. You want to get out. Today, in general, the lifestyle has gone up in Israel all over. It's very hard to find the real shikunim, the really depressed housing blocks, and in these places as well, but still, they are not easy places. And the ones in the south have to contend with security issues as well as economic issues, as we've seen in the last few months, but going on for 20, 30 more years. So let's talk about the one that's probably the most famous for security issues, and that's Sderot. Sderot is founded in 1951 as a ma'abara, but in 1954 it already becomes a town. It is infamous for rocket attacks because it's close to the border, but it's not so close, right? The trajectory of the rockets, it's a perfect trajectory to hit Sderot. So Sderot, unfortunately, gets many, many attacks. It has shelters all over the place. But it's still a big and a thriving city. At the moment, not so much, but the population is about 30,000 people, new shopping centers, new development. This is the school over here on the left, right? When it's first when Sderot is first created. But today there's a college, Michlelet Sapir, there's industrial zones, there's malls, there's a film festival. And one of the things that's interesting, right? Well, Sderot is starts out being populated largely by Moroccans, right? In the 60s, the population was something like 87% Moroccans. Later waves of immigration have also moved down there. So today you have Russians, you have Ethiopians, there's a Romanian group. One of the things that's fascinating about Sderot is it became a music center. Okay? A lot of musicians started out in Sderot, and it's a very interesting mix of like traditional Mizrahi music mixed with rock music. The guy on the right here is Micha Biton. He's somebody who came from Sderot. He lives today in Netiv HaAsara. He's been performing a lot in the wake of what happened on October 7th. But one of the kind of older stars of Sderot is somebody named Kobi Oz. Kobi Oz was a big rock star in the 90s, the 2000s. He's still around. And he does a lot of interesting things, but I wanted you to see the beginning of this video because in it, he incorporates his grandfather's singing piyutim into his song. So let's listen to the beginning of it.
You're not hearing anything.
There's no
This is
sound.
Kobi's bar mitzvah.
There's
That's
no
him.
sound. We didn't hear anything. No sound. No sound.
What?
No
No
sound.
sound? Okay, that's not good. Hold on. Why do we have no sound? Hold on. I think I have to do something on my screen sharing. Just a second. We'll come right back. We will come right back. I have to enable sound on the video separately. Sorry. Share sound. Missing that. Okay. Coming back. Let's try again. Tell me if it works. Yes?
Yes.
יש לי כל כך הרבה דברים לספר לך, ואתה הרי הכל. הכל יודע. יש לי הרבה בקשות לבקש ממך, אבל אתה הרי חפץ בטובתי ממילא. אני נותן לך חיוך קטן על כל דבר יפה שבו אני מבחין. מרשים אוהדים ואני קצת נבוך, אני לא יודע איך לקרוא לך אלוהים או אלוקים. יש לי המון תודות, תודות, תודות עומדות בתור ולדלתך, אבל תודות יוצאות לי קיץ'. יש לי מלא בקשות, 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 בקשות לבקש ממך, למרות שאצלי בסך הכל הכל בסדר.
Okay, I don't know if everybody was getting all the sound, all the words, but it's basically a tefillah, right? He's talking to God, Elohai, and I don't know what to call you, and I have so many things to tell you, and I want to thank you for so many things. Kobios comes out with these songs. Today, religious singers are becoming part of the mainstream in Israeli pop. But when he was coming out with these songs, it wasn't mainstream. And one of the ideas here is that he's coming from this area of Sderot, which is a very traditional town, right? The Jews who are coming from North Africa, from Yemen, they're very traditional. Even if they're not, you know, following every single one of the 613 mitzvot, this is their culture. This is who they are. It was different from the European Jews. And he beautifully brings that out by showing his grandfather and showing his bar mitzvah. And I just really liked it a lot. I thought it just was a nice example of what's going on in Sderot. Ofakim. Okay, Ofakim is founded in 1955. Again, Moroccans. What?
Your camera is not on. We don't see you.
I can't.
Some of us see you.
What? You don't see me? I'm here.
Oh, we don't see your face.
Okay.
No,
everybody
your face
good?
Is gone.
I'm here. My camera is on.
I'm not having any problem.
You're not on.
All right. You can see the video, the PowerPoint. That's what's important. I'm less important. But my camera is definitely on, so it might be you guys, I hope.
You have to change the view if you want to see her. You have to change the view if you want to see her. If not, you know,
okay.
You just
I'm
see
not
the
so beautiful. All right. Moving along.
You're
Ofakim.
Back.
Ofakim. Okay. Ofakim. Awesome. Also Moroccans, Tunisians today. It's also a nice sized town, 34,000 people. It had a big textile manufacturing plant, which kind of went bust. And so again, economic issues. Ofakim is probably most famous now in the last few months because of the lady on the right. Okay. This is Rachel Edrei. In the first days of the war, when we really didn't know what was going on and the story started to trickle in, I remember it was like the second day of the war or something. My son sent me this crazy story about this woman who was like Yael in Tanakh, meaning she had the terrorists in her house and she kept saying, oh, do you want a drink? I'll make you cookies. And she managed to keep them at bay until the army was able to save her. And she just kept her cool and she was able to signal to the soldiers and she became like a real folk hero. Since then, we've had a lot of amazing stories, but she, Rachel and her cookies became like a meme. Everybody was talking about it and she's become the object, the subject of quite a few graffitis. And so here she is in Ofakim. In Ofakim in general, there was a lot of bravery fighting back against the terrorists and she's one of the great stories here. And another very quirky story is this story. Some people might remember this story. In 1977, there was a civil war in Vietnam, and there were Vietnamese who were fleeing. Remember the Vietnamese boat people trying to get out anywhere they could. And there was a fishing boat with 66 men, women, and children on it. And an Israeli freighter came across them. Nobody else had stopped, and they took them on board and they saved their lives. But then the question was what to do with them. No country went. Taiwan didn't want them. Japan didn't. Nobody wanted them. And so they wrote back to Israel. They said, well, what should we do with these people? And the Knesset decided that we were going to give them refuge. And this was decided on the very first day of Menachem Begin's tenure in government. Here's Menachem Begin in the picture. And this is on June 18th, 1977, Menachem Begin's first day in government. He says, I remember the stories, the story of the St. Louis and the Jewish refugees who were not taken in by anybody, and we will not do that, and we're going to take them in. And he takes in these Vietnamese men, women, and children, and where do they go? They go to Ofakim. And the first baby that's born, there was one of the women was pregnant, and the baby was born in Ofakim, and they decided to call him Ofek. After this, we took in some more, and some of them went to Afula, and some of them left for other places, but it is a great story. And some of them are still here, and their children are here, and there was even somebody who said some of them serve in the army. Like, there definitely are some that are still here. So that's another connection to Ofakim. Okay, Netivot. Netivot is 1956. Again, the same demographic, Morocco, Tunisia, later Russians, Ethiopians. This is the guy Niladim on the left. If you think I made a mistake here on the right and I decided to talk about French Jews, no. This is Paris Center in Netivot with a replica of the Eiffel Tower. It's very classy. Okay, so that's in Netivot. But Netivot is not famous for its replica of the Eiffel Tower. It is famous for its mystics. Okay. Netivot is the place where you go to the grave of the Baba Sali. The Baba Sali is Rabbi Yisrael Abuchatzera on the left. He lived a very long life. He lived to be almost 100. Born in Morocco in 1889 to a family of scholars and miracle workers, people said. Okay? When he's already not a young man in the 50s, he comes to Israel. People want to give him all these positions. They want to make him chief rabbi. He's not interested in any of these things. He eventually goes back to Morocco to help the community there. And then in 1964, he returns and he moves to Netivot. And he lives in Netivot for 20 years till he dies in 1984. His son is now also a rabbi, Rabbi Baruch Abuchatzera in Netivot. But his burial, his grave became a huge pilgrimage site. Thousands of people go there every year. People believe that this, you know, you can pray there and everything will be given to you, right? It's a classic Kever Tzadik, but it's interesting because it's a modern one. The fellow on the right is somewhat more controversial. This is Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Ifergan. He doesn't look Eastern, but he is. He's also Moroccan, if I remember correctly. And he's more known by his nickname. His nickname is the Rentgen, or the X-ray. Okay? He is a Kabbalist. He's a healer. He claims he can tell you what's wrong with you just by looking at you. Some people really believe in him and come to him for blessings. Others think he's a big charlatan. What nobody disputes is that he's very, very, very rich, and he doesn't particularly like paying taxes. But he's another one of these guys. So Netivot has this very interesting kind of like a mystical bent. If Sderot is the musical city, Netivot is the mystical city. Okay. We're going to finish up with two different things. One is this idea of Second Israel. Okay? This is a phrase that's become more popular in the last few decades. And that's the issues of discrimination, of bias, of the fact that these guys from North Africa or from Kurdistan are sent to the borders, are sent to the peripheries. Of course, that's ignoring the fact that you also have Vatikim who are living on the periphery. But, you know, they look at it and they say, well, the Europeans got to move into Katamonim and Baka, and we got stuck in Netivot and Ofakim. There was a lot of cultural bias. There was a lot of discrimination. A lot of these stories are coming out now. A lot of this is also stories that have not been told, right? If we have so much of a history of Holocaust history and talking about European Jewry, we talk much less about the Jews of Arab countries. And this is another, I'll play just a few minutes of it, but this is another Kobe O song where he talks about how we don't know the stories of our ancestors who come from Arab countries, and we need to know that. So it starts out with his mother, who says, Lo haya lanu klum.
Even
though we had nothing, everybody would help each other. And he's going to
be first. בעיר ביזרתה ספינות גרמניה נכנסות אל הנמל פתאום כולנו פליטים ברגע מביטים אחורה
והעולם נופל
ועוד איך עוד יום לא רואים את האור וכולם צועקים ביחד לתקווה שתחזור לא היה לנו כלום מלבד
אהבה
לא היה לנו כלום ובכל זאת הסתדרנו לא היה לנו כלום מלבד אהבה בינינו לא היה לנו כלום ובכל זאת הסתדרנו
Story, but just to see all those beautiful faces and to know that there are a lot of stories that have not been told. And now, today, we're really living in an Israel where you have Mizrahi Jews who have reached the highest echelons of the government, of the army, of everything. And now those stories are starting to be told again. Okay, we'll do one last thing. This is the backlash, the Black Panthers, the riots in Wadi Salib. Mizrahi Jews fighting for more opportunities, equal opportunities, which eventually come, but it's a long time. Okay. Finally, attacks and counterattacks. There are many terror attacks from Gaza into these communities, many of them encouraged by the Egyptians, carried out by the refugees who are there, and they sneak across the border and they attack, the kibbutzim, the moshavim. The army ultimately forms a unit called, a very famous, infamous Unit 101, led by Ariel Sharon, that carries out reprisal attacks, that goes into Arab territories and carries out reprisal attacks. Some people say they went too far. And one of the famous attacks is the attack of the Black Arrow, the Black Arrow attack. This is the Black Arrow Memorial, that shows you like near where they went in. This was in, March of 1955. They went over the border, attacked the Egyptian army in a reprisal, right? And this is very much reprisals over and over again. Terrorists came over the border into Patish, and that was that picture I showed you before of David Ben-Gurion after the terror attack there. So you have this memorial of the Chet HaShachor, the Black Arrow, in the northern Negev along the border, talking about these various reprisal attacks, and it's a memorial to the people who fell trying to fight back and trying to provide some deterrence against the attacks from Gaza. And we'll finish with this story. This is a very difficult story. It's a very difficult thing to read, but whenever I read it, I always feel like it's something that was written in 1956, but could have been written last week. And this takes us back to Nachal Oz. Roy Rothberg, was a young man from Tel Aviv. He wanted to be a pioneer. He comes down to the young kibbutz Nachal Oz, 1953. He becomes the head security officer. Now, if you remember back a half hour ago, we said Nachal Oz, no fence, the last furrow, all right, that's our border. And that was their philosophy. And here he is. He's the guy on the horse on the right here, the handsome guy. And he would go out, and he would, you know, survey and make sure that things were safe. April 29th, 1956 was Lag BaOmer, and he went out to survey the perimeter of the kibbutz to see that everything was okay. Terrorists had come across the border. They attacked him. They dragged him back to Gaza. They murdered him and mutilated his body. Terrible, terrible story. Ultimately, his body was brought back. But what makes this story one that we remember more than others is because it was Lag BaOmer, there were going to be four weddings in the kibbutz that day. And there were a lot of guests who came. And one of the guests was an army officer named Moshe Dayan. And Moshe Dayan gave the eulogy at Roy Rothberg's funeral. And this is what he said. And it speaks for itself. Early yesterday morning, Roy was murdered. The quiet of the spring morning dazzled him, and he did not see those waiting in ambush for him at the edge of the furrow. Let us not cast the blame on the murderers today. Why should we declare their burning hatred for us? For 8 years, they have been sitting in the refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we have been transforming the lands and the villages where they and their fathers dwelt into our estate. It is not among the Arabs in Gaza, but in our own midst that we must seek Roy's blood. How do we shut our eyes and refuse to look squarely at our fate and see in all its brutality the destiny of our generation? Have we forgotten that this group of young people dwelling at Nahal Oz is bearing the heavy gates of Gaza on its shoulders? Beyond the furrow of the border, a sea of hatred and desire for revenge is swelling, awaiting the day when serenity will dull our path, for the day when we will heed the ambassadors of malevolent hypocrisy who call upon us to lay down our arms. Roy's blood is crying out to us, and only to us, from his torn body. Although we have sworn a thousandfold that our blood shall not flow in vain, yesterday again we were tempted, we listened, we believed. We will make our reckoning with ourselves today. We are a generation that settles the land, and without the steel helmet and the cannon's maw, we will not be able to plant a tree and build a home. Let us not be deterred from seeing the loathing that is inflaming and filling the lives of the hundreds of thousands of Arabs who live around us. Let us not avert our eyes, lest our arms weaken. This is the fate of our generation. This is our life's choice, to be prepared and armed, strong and determined, lest the sword be stricken from our fists and our lives cut down. The young Roi who left Tel Aviv to build his home at the gates of Gaza to be a wall for us was blinded by the light in his heart, and he did not see the flash of the sword. The yearning for peace deafened his ears, and he did not hear the voice of murder waiting in ambush. The gates of Gaza weighed too heavily on his shoulders and overcame him. Okay, we're going to stop here. Next week will be a little bit more positive. Don't worry. That's a hard ending. But we did have a lot of building and growing. Okay. Udon Sharon under Jordan in 1948. Correct. They should be forgiven for the pessimism. Yes, that's true. Better to be optimistic. Okay. Maale Gilboa is missing from the map. Oh, interesting. Maale Gilboa is also a Heyachuz Nahal we're talking about. All right. I don't know. I did not make the map. Yemenite family on the Tayelet in Jerusalem. There's like that Olim. Are they supposed to be Yemenites? Is that true? I don't know. Okay. Tunisia, more similar to Morocco than to Algeria. Yeah, the Moroccans is very interesting. The Moroccans today, right? Morocco today is still mostly friendly to Jews. He donated cases of shoes. Very nice. Okay. Developing kind of, right. Development is an oxymoron, right? Interesting. Rock in the Red Zone, a documentary film about the many rock and roll bands that have come out of State Road. Thank you. Very nice. Okay, sound, screen, yes. Which is the same, Lag BaOmer, of course, right, of course. Yes, Roi is still a very popular name. All right, thank you, everyone. I don't know if anybody who wrote in, Maale Gilboa is in the north, but I think the question was if it's a Nahal settlement. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Next week, we will do Gush Katif and Sinai. So come wearing your sandals. Okay. Goodbye. Have a good rest of the week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Toda rabah.
Bakasha.